Okay, well, welcome everybody. It is 1 o'clock East Coast time, 10 o'clock here, 11 o'clock in Boise, Idaho, where we're starting our first group start. They're in the middle of the group launch in Boise. Bill and all those people up there, welcome. So great to have a new chapter in Boise, Idaho. Fantastic. Really important state for us, and we're glad you're there all making this happen. I want to welcome the other new groups since last month's call, Colorado Springs, Colorado, Missoula, Montana, Carson City, Nevada, State College, Pennsylvania, and Curtin, Australia. So we've had active people working in Australia, but we actually had never done a group launch. And so the first one happened, and we're obviously really, really excited about that. Just want to mention one thing real quick. We'll be introducing our speaker in just a second. Before we do that, I know that we're all very enthusiastic about the fact that former Secretary of State Schultz is on our board, and I see him mentioned in a lot of the op-eds and letters that we write. And if we could just be a little bit more careful about spelling his name, there is no C in Secretary Schultz. So if you're writing about Sergeant Schultz, you could put a C in. And I think you could make a case for Sergeant Schultz and Hogan Heroes and I Know Nothing. But if we're talking about Secretary Schultz, if we could be a little more careful on the spelling, that would be really, really great. Before we get to today's speaker, Dr. Joseph, are you there? Can you unmute your line for just a second if you are? Peter?
I'm here, Mark. Can you hear me?
Okay, fantastic. Peter, thank you so much. So, Peter, you just want to talk a little bit about what's happening in Nepal, and if you would take a moment to do that before we welcome our speaker, that would be really great.
Yes, thank you very much, Mark. As many of you know, CCL has a small chapter in Kathmandu, Nepal, and as everybody knows, that place was struck by a massive earthquake 2 weeks ago. My friend and co-author of the MIT proposal, Gary Horvitz, has been in Nepal for over a month, prepared to lecture on climate change and starting a CCL presence over there with the head of the chapter, Arian Upreti. And he's been traveling around giving lectures at schools until 2 weeks ago when everything was turned upside down. Now, I have arranged through a small charitable organization on which I serve on the board called 100 Friends. This is an organization that's very small, very lean, and very efficient, and they have agreed to channel donations to CCL Nepal. What we're being asked for is approximately $2,000. $1,000 for relief efforts that Arian is participating in a group of citizen volunteers that was just recognized by the United Nations, according to Joe Robertson, with whom I just spoke. And the next $1,000 would be to help get the CCL presence back on its feet in Kathmandu. So all one needs to do to contribute on a tax-deductible basis is go to 100, that is the number 100friends.org. There's a field where you can direct your donation specifically to CCL Nepal. And I can guarantee that money will find its way to Arian. And I think a show of support for a dedicated CCL member who's an outstanding citizen at this crucial time would be highly appropriate for Citizens Climate Lobby. Please keep the people of Nepal in your thoughts. I know Gary is safe, and we're all thinking about all of them. Thank you very much.
Great, Peter. Thank you so much. It's so typical of you. Dr. Joseph has been so generous with his time and actually what he's donated both financially and his time to here. So great for you to ask to do that, and it's important, and we really, really appreciate it. Okay, so Tony Leiserwitz from the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication is our speaker. And, you know, this session is more like a training than our usual education, because we're going to be talking about the tool and how to use the tool that they've developed, the Yale Climate Opinion Maps. I think most of the people on this call are pretty familiar with Tony. He's been a keynote speaker for our conference. He's been on this call before. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the Six Americas, and that's part of the work that Tony and his team developed. But, Tony, I told you that you'd make some opening comments before the first questions, but actually I'd like you to answer one of the first questions as part of your opening comments, and this is from George in Alaska. He said, since I first heard of you on a CCL call, I've always been impressed by your work and your commitment to solving the climate crisis. I'm fascinated with your work, like your project on the Six Americas, and follow you and the Yale E360 on Twitter. I listen to podcasts of interviews with you, and I've heard you on the radio, and there is one thing I'd like to ask you. Will you pronounce your name for us? So if you would please do that as part of your opening comments, we would really, really appreciate that.
Sure. So thank you, Mark. that's the hardest question I get all day, I hope. So my name is Anthony Lizerwitz, unless you would like to try to be Lithuanian about it, in which case it would be Lizerovich, but nobody can do that. So it's Lizerwitz. That's the correct pronunciation.
Great.
Thank you so much, Mark, for the opportunity to join you again. CCL is one of my all-time favorite groups in the world. You guys are doing fantastic work. It's exactly the kind of work that needs to be done to make this issue happen, and action on this issue happen here in the United States and around the world. So it's just a real pleasure to be back with you all. For those of you who don't know me, let me quickly introduce the Yale Project and what we do. The project basically does two things, research, which I'll mostly talk about today, but also outreach, and I'll talk momentarily about that. On the research side, we try to understand how do mass publics respond to the issue. What do they understand? What do they misunderstand about the causes, the consequences, and solutions to climate change? How do they perceive the risks? What kinds of policies they support or oppose? And what kinds of behaviors are members of the public engaged in around climate and energy? So how do people actually use and conserve energy at home and on the road? Their consumer behavior, so what kinds of products and services will they prefer? To what extent will they reward or punish companies for their actions on climate change? We look at social behavior, especially how we talk about it, or more often how we don't talk about it. And then last but not least, and right at the heart of CCL, is political behavior. To what extent will citizens actually get engaged to demand that the broader system change and take action? Then in the end, we are pointing ahead to scientists, so our ultimate question is answering why. What are the psychological, cultural, and political reasons why some people get really engaged with this issue, others are kind of apathetic, and then others are downright hostile and dismissive? And our work then spans many different geographic scales. Nationally, of course, we've done a lot of, I think we're up to about 15 very in-depth national studies of how Americans respond. We've increasingly been doing a lot more work at the state and local level, as I'll talk about in a moment. But we also work internationally as well, having done studies in China and India and elsewhere around the world. The other thing I want to just mention quickly is that we also host Yale Climate Connections. This is an online multimedia news service about climate change, and in particular a radio program that we started just about a half a year ago. We're currently on in about 190 radio stations across the United States and Canada. And we would encourage you to come to yaleclimateconnections.org, where the podcasts are available. These are 90-second stories, a brand new one every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And it's really about trying to connect the dots between climate change, which is for so many people this abstract, distant, scientific issue, and bring it down to earth, to bring it into the here and now and connect it to our daily lives and our values. And in particular, highlight the stories of the people and organizations all over the country who are actually bringing this transition to a clean, prosperous, sustainable future into being right now. Because most of us don't know all the incredibly inspirational things that people are doing. And it's just been a really fun personal trip for me to learn about all the amazing things people are doing. So anyway, I would encourage you to come take a listen, and hopefully it's playing on a radio station near you. Okay, so for today, I want to talk a bit about a new thing that we've been working on for a couple years and just made public a couple weeks ago. And that's what we're calling Yale Climate Opinion Maps. And you should be able to get to it from the front page of our website. It's environment.yale.edu/climate. And in the upper right-hand corner will be a button that says Yale Climate Opinion Maps. So I hope those of you who can go take a look at that as I talk about this. But you can always go there after the call if you don't have internet access right now. What we've been doing is, or what we've done is, we, of course, have been doing national-level surveys for many, many years. But And here's the reason why we have done this. This is called downscaling. It's basically a model that we've developed that allows us to estimate public opinion and engagement with the issue of climate change for all 50 states, for all 435 congressional districts, and all 3,000-plus counties in the United States. And the motivation for this was, first of all, scientific. We knew that there was tremendous diversity of public engagement below the surface of national polls. National surveys are great. We've learned tremendous things. It gave us things like the Six Americas analysis and so on. But we always knew that there was far more going on below the surface of national survey numbers. But no one has the money to go out and do studies in all 50 states and 435 congressional districts and so on and so forth. So what we've done is built a model that allows us to estimate public opinion in all of those different levels. And then, very critically, we validated those estimates. It's not good enough to just come up with estimates. You want to know, are they accurate? And so that was a key part of our work, where we built the model, we developed the estimates at the state and congressional district and county level, but then we actually went out and did separate surveys, independent surveys, in four states and two cities to see how well the model actually performs against actual survey data. And the good news is that it performed exceptionally well. It's well within the survey's margin of error, and to be honest, we don't actually know which is more accurate, these model estimates or the surveys themselves, because surveys, of course, always have a margin of error around them. So the first thing is that we're exceptionally excited because it's now, for the very first time, allowing us to see the diversity of viewpoints below the surface of national numbers. I like to say it's almost like someone's just suddenly given me a microscope, and you can suddenly see all these patterns below the surface. The second major motivation, however, was very practical, and that is that most decisions about climate change are happening at the state and local level. To quote the famous quote of former Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill, is that all politics is local, including national politics. Every senator, every member of Congress comes from a state, comes from a congressional district, where they have to pay attention to people like you, as well as their broader set of constituents. So we are constantly asked, well, I love what you told me about national numbers, but what's going on where I live or where I work? So these maps are the first attempt to really provide an answer to all of you. And in fact, CCL was one of the primary audiences that we built this tool for and with in mind. So with that said, let me quickly introduce those of you who can follow along to the tool. First of all, I just want to emphasize again, these are not poll numbers. We have not gone out and done surveys in all 50 states and all 435 congressional districts and all 3,000-plus counties. That would be unbelievably expensive, though if anyone out there wants to give me $100 million to do it, you know, call me after the call. What we have done is to build this statistical model that allows us to estimate these at all of that. So that's important because when you go out and you talk about it with other people, it's important to use that word estimate. These are not poll numbers directly. They are estimates. They happen to be very accurate estimates, and that's why we put a lot of stock in them. But I just want you to make sure you conceptually understand what you're looking at. Okay, so if you happen to be looking at the tool right now, and I hope many of you are, you will see at the top of this the question, is global warming happening? And it says estimated percent of adults who think that global warming is happening in 2014. And if you click on the dialogue box right below that, or the pop-up box, you'll see that we've provided the results for 14 different questions. A set of beliefs: is global warming happening? Is it mostly human-caused? Do most scientists think it's happening? A set of risk perception questions: to what extent are people worried about it? Do they think it's already harming people in the United States? Will it harm me personally? Will it harm other people in the U.S.? Will it harm developing countries or future generations? And then policy support questions: do people support funding research into renewable energy sources? Do they support regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant? Do they further support setting strict CO2 limits on existing coal-fired power plants, which, of course, is the essence of the EPA's clean power plan right now? Do they support requiring utilities to produce 20% electricity from renewable sources? And then a question that really was asked and built into this explicitly for CCL, a carbon tax if refunded to every American household. So those are the different things, the different questions that we have provided in this version of the tool. It will grow, and we will add additional questions over time, but that's what's here now. And then on the left-hand side of the map, you will see that you can see the results at the national scale, at the state level, at the congressional district level, or the county level. And you can click on any of those. So I'm just going to pick a question, worried about global warming. And at the national level, we see that 52% of Americans say that they are somewhat or very worried about global warming, which isn't a great number. And we could say much more about that, but here I'm just trying to show you what the tool can do. But, of course, 52% nationally, that's interesting, but what does that tell me about where I'm working? So if you click on the state level, you will see that there is tremendous variation around the country, ranging from states like, say, New York, where 63% of New Yorkers are worried about it, California, where 62% of Californians are worried about it, down to states like West Virginia, where only 42% are worried about global warming. So already at the state level, or if you happen to be talking to a U.S. senator, this is providing you with a measure of what's going on within each of the 50 states. But then we've gone down to the congressional district level, and if you click on that, you should very quickly see how these results come out for every congressional district in America. And then if you click on the county level button, you can get down to the smallest geographic scale and see that, in fact, there's tremendous variation around the country and within specific states. And since we're here, let me just point out one that really pops out for me, and that's the state of Texas, which for many people, people just see Texas as a deep red, very conservative state. It's led by a climate-denying governor, Rick Perry. You know, it would not be seen to be a place that's very hospitable to a climate change message. But when you look down at the county level, you see that there's actually tremendous variation within the state. And in fact, all the counties along the U.S.-Mexico border are actually quite similar to counties in, say, New York State or even California or Arizona or New Mexico, whereas it's the northeastern side of Texas where there's more doubt and skepticism and less worry about it. That's really picking up, we're pretty sure, the influence of Latinos, who in our other research we've identified as the racial and ethnic group in America that care the most about climate change. Not upper middle class white people, as I think many people have the stereotype, but Latinos actually are the most convinced it's happening and human caused and worry the most about it, and moreover support policy action about it, more than any other racial or ethnic group in the country. And so you can see that even within the state of Texas. You can do that same kind of look at any other state in the country. And by the way, if you then hover over the map itself, you can click on any county or congressional district or state that you happen to be looking at, and the map will immediately zoom in and show you what the results are for that particular question for that particular area, whether it's a county, congressional district, or state. Also, you should note that there's a little magnifying glass in the upper right-hand corner. You can always click that to go back out to the national level. And also, if you happen to be clicked on a particular state or something like that and you want to share those results with somebody, you can click the permalink button, which will open up a link that will take someone that you send that to directly to the exact county that you happen to be looking at, as an example, for that one variable. The other thing that I want to just quickly point out is that when you do click on, say, an individual congressional district, and here for the sake of interest, I'm going to look at the 4th district in Missouri. It immediately zooms you into that district. You can then immediately see below the answers of that district and how worried they are, or any other variable you choose, how they compare to the rest of that state, and then how they compare to the answer for the entire United States. And then below that, you will see all of those variables I've mentioned, the beliefs, the risk perceptions, and the policy support results for that specific district. So if you want to print it off because you, let's say you're only working in that one district, you don't care about the rest of the country, you can print this one page and you'll have it all in one spot. I think last thing to say here is that when you're zoomed back out to the whole national level, take a look at the and hover your mouse over the legend, and you will see that for any color that you happen to hover over, it will the map will highlight those specific areas that where it's estimated that public has that particular range of beliefs. So that's fun to play with to see those kinds of patterns too. And then in the upper right-hand corner, there's more information about how the maps are constructed, how to interpret it. There's even a data download where you can download the data underlying this map for yourself if you want to do your own analyses and so on. So anyway, that's the basic tool. And one thing I will point out at the bottom, and this is specifically for CCL, is that variable or the question, a carbon tax if refunded to every American household. When you click on that, you will see that the map turns pretty blue. And I want to explain that because it's important to see what's going on there. So if you happen to be looking at, say, the state level, you'll see that only Hawaii and New York is there at least 50% or more of the public that supports a carbon tax if refunded to every American household. Now, that might seem bad, but I want you to then look at the bars down below because it's important to see that to interpret this correctly. When you do that and you look at, say, the United States level, you'll see that 44% of Americans support this policy and only 25% oppose it. The rest are in gray, and that means that they don't know. They have not decided. They don't have an opinion. And so what that says is that while you don't have over half the country supporting this policy yet, it's essentially a jump ball. This is a brand new policy. Most people have never heard of a carbon tax before. They've certainly never heard of the idea of returning tax money or dividend money back to every American household. So it really points to the incredible importance of the kind of work you're doing to educate people about this policy and why it will benefit them, why they should care. I would say overall, this shows that by and large, there's more support than there is opposition for this, depending on where you live. But in most parts of the country, that's true. But there's still a very sizable number of Americans who just haven't decided yet. So keep that in mind as you work on this particular policy option. The only other thing then to quickly mention is that we also did a separate analysis that you can also find on the front page of our website, which compares using these modeled estimates, the views of U.S. senators versus their constituents on the question of, is global warming happening and human-caused? So many of you may know that a couple months ago there was a set of amendments in which all of the U.S. Senate had to vote, one of which was an amendment proposed by Brian Schatz, Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii, which basically said, do you agree that global warming or climate change is caused is happening and significantly caused by human activities. And what we've done in this analysis, and you can go and click on it and look at the chart yourself, we've compared each senator's vote about whether they agree with that versus the viewpoints of their own constituents. And it's a pretty interesting finding because, first of all, nationally you find that in almost every state there are more people who say, yes, global warming is happening and human caused, then say the opposite. There's only, in fact, really one state, Wyoming, where beyond the margins of error, essentially, there's slightly more people who think that it's not happening than think it is. But moreover, you can see how each senator voted on this question and see where there are some interesting discrepancies, like Cory Gardner in Colorado, where Coloradans overall are plus 17 points, are more likely to say that global warming is happening human-caused than that it's natural or not happening at all. So anyway, I would encourage you to go take a look at that because that might be useful to you as well. And, Mark, I think with that, I'll stop and take some questions.
Okay, great. Let me just first of all say I got more questions for you than for any caller in the past. And, we're going to get to a couple of them, but people are really interested and excited about this. Just so everybody knows, we have imported this report into our database. So when you get your schedule this year, it'll have the information on your members of the House and Senate coming from this report. And as you know, you know, for instance, there's 18 people in one congressional district coming from Wisconsin to the conference. From those of you who've been to the conference before know, usually House offices hold four or five people. So there's lots of times we'll be lobbying in offices that we're not constituents, so you'll probably be familiar with your information, but if you're not familiar with it for other districts, that will be what you get as part of your schedule. First question, Tony, comes from, actually, our Marin chapter, Peter Joseph, who was just speaking. He said, your results for refunded carbon tax differ from the recent Stanford and Resources for the Future study showing two-thirds of support. Can you talk about the difference between that study and what the results we have here?
I can't without actually looking at their questions, which I haven't done, but I do know that in general there are some important methodological differences. Most notably, the Stanford researchers generally never allow people the opportunity to say that I don't know whether I support something or not. They essentially force people to make a choice. We believe, and this is just a methodological difference, is that we believe don't know is a really important answer. It's not just something that a few people use because they're lazy. It's a real answer for most things, especially when it comes to a policy like this, which, as I indicated before, most people have never heard of. I mean, this is really a different concept, you know, except for those few people who live in Alaska. So we think don't know is a really important answer, and that's why we make sure we offer it as an option.
Okay, that makes complete sense. Okay, then there's a question from Zori Zimmerman from one of our Massachusetts chapters. She said, what are your suggestions for messaging a revenue-neutral carbon tax in a few words? In the April 22nd A&E article about Yale University planning to self-impose a revenue-neutral carbon tax on itself, I love the description of a carbon tax as a financial lever to shift social behavior. But do you think, as some supporters of a carbon tax warm, that this characterization calls up the specter of social engineering and thus we should avoid this concept? If so, how else should we describe its transformative power without frightening people?
Yeah, well, that is a great question, and I wish I had a full answer for it. I don't. I think this is going to be tricky. You know, I think this is one of those policies that if it was successfully passed, it would revolutionize the issue, and I know all of you agree with me on this. The hardest part, I think, is actually getting it passed in the first place, because it will not, at least, you know, in its strictest sense, where every single dollar that is collected will go back to all American taxpayers. As a result, that doesn't, you know, it leaves out a lot of vested interests who tend to have a lot of political power and sway within Washington, D.C. So, you know, if you're a utility, you're not getting anything out of this. If you're an auto manufacturer, you're not getting anything out of this, and we can go on down the list. So, you know, I can see that it's an important frame. We do see that this idea of revenue neutrality seems to actually be very useful for the broader topic of a carbon tax, leaving aside the dividend approach. And I think what we're really picking up on there is that people are pretty frustrated and cynical about Congress. You know, Congress's approval ratings right now are unbelievably low. For a while they were, I think, below cockroaches and the idea of making the United States go communist. So, you know, they're not operating with a whole lot of goodwill and trust right now from most of the public. And I think what we've tapped into is this sense that they don't trust Congress with another dollar, especially those people who are against the idea of bigger government in general. So that's what I think is actually one of the real potentially useful things about this idea of revenue neutrality, if you can convince people, and this will be hard, that it's for real. Because I think they've seen governments do these kind of bait and switches of things like, well, we're going to institute a state lottery to raise money for education, which they do, but then, of course, they take away the money that they were otherwise allocating to education and just replace it with the lottery money and use that money for something else entirely. So there's not a whole lot of trust there, and I think that broader issue of how do you give people confidence that this policy will work the way it's intended is going to be a really important challenge to overcome.
Great. All right. Well, I mean, I wish I could have time to answer the other 10 questions that were submitted, and maybe I can submit them to you separately and we can post them for people, because I was overwhelmed with questions again, and you know, it's obvious why you've been such a, you know, often requested speaker for us, and you know, we're so grateful that you created this tool. And if you can stay on for the rest of the call, great. But it is a Saturday. We'll understand if you need to drop off at this point. But thank you so much again.
Well, and thank you again, Mark, and thank you to everyone on this call. It's your passion, it's your energy that's going to make the difference. So keep it up.
All right. We will. Thank you, sir. All right. Well, that was great again. Amy Bennett, are you there? Amy, can you unmute your phone? Cool.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, crap, I was going to do your report for you. That's what I've always wanted to do, is to take Amy's part. So, Amy, a couple updates real quick on how things are happening. Give us, first of all, just let us know what's happening, where we are with the conference, how many people are registered so far, how are we doing with appointments so far?
Mark, we have 660 people registered for the conference in June in Washington, D.C., and the numbers of meetings that we already have scheduled are 115, and 24 of those are face-to-face. So that's
right.
Face-to-face with the Congress member. The other 91 are with staff, energy staffers, et cetera.
Which is
so
great.
We're looking really good.
Yeah, because we've just been focusing on staff so far, and now's the point that we're a little closer to the conference. We start shifting to face-to-face, and you know, as we all know from the Amy Bennett method, one time of making a request and following up is never enough. Sometimes it takes between 7 and 10 follow-ups, you know, on a gentle basis to actually get that confirmed, and we want to be kicking that into full gear now, right?
Right.
Okay, excellent. And then just so everybody knows, a couple of things about the conference. I know everybody knows Catherine Hayhoe is going to be there for the keynote in the morning. Our panel of experts right after that includes Dr. Hansen, Shiling Su, and Kelly from Ceres. There's 27 breakout sessions that, you know, Shiling Su's doing a breakout, Sam Daly-Harry's doing a breakout, Dr. Hansen's a member of the agriculture breakout. Part of the social activity we're kind of excited about Monday night is the director of Chasing Ice is going to be there, along with the executive director of Years of Living Dangerously. So they'll be talking a little bit about their projects and have a Q&A period. So in addition to some kind of down social time, we're excited that they both wanted to come to the conference and that they could do a little bit of a presentation there. And just a reminder of one thing I mentioned during Tony's remarks is we are scheduling 535 meetings, hopefully. Usually you can fit about 5 people in a House office and 7 in a Senate, so not all of us from the same district. Like in my district, a lot of people are coming. We'll be in our exact meeting, but we'll do our best to can to make sure that it's certainly loaded up with constituents. Okay, Amy, what are some of the other things that jump out to you this month?
Well, Marcus, you know we had Earth Day, Earth Week this month, and so for outreach events, we had 264 events, which is fabulous.
Amazing. Yep.
And then a really high figure, also probably related to that, is op-eds. We had 52 op-eds.
Incredible.
And then we had a lot of groups who, if they did do tabling on Earth Day, they asked people to write a letter to Congress or write a personal postcard to Congress. And we had the count of personal letters to Congress was 1,792 for this month.
1,792. I don't know, Amy, is that the most we've ever done in one month?
It is.
Okay.
And I wanted to highlight Austin, Texas with 578, Miami, Florida with 273, and Dallas, Texas with 148.
Wow. So for everybody who did those outreach events and had people write notes to their member of Congress, you know, that's one of the things we hear consistently in congressional offices is that they don't hear from people often enough. So thank you for doing that. That is extraordinary work, and we really, really appreciate it. Anything else that you want to mention this month, Amy?
Just a great month overall. And, oh, one other thing is about those 535 meetings. We are going to get them all.
Okay, good. I feel good about that, Amy. Okay.
I'm confident.
Good. All right, excellent. Okay, so then just a couple of things that I want to highlight a little bit this month. One is our groups in Iowa, really headed up by a lot of people, but I'm just going to mention Greg and Rob Hogue, brought Marshall out there for a week because the Iowa caucuses are the first things that you know, influence the presidential debates. They had 16 meetings in 3 days, which included 3 editorial board meetings, radio, television, a lot to talk. So thank you for all of that. We got a huge amount of media coverage, and Marshall loved being there. So for everybody in Iowa who was part of that, we're really, really grateful about the work that you did on that. I also want to mention that Judy Weiss, Rabbi Judy Weiss, in one of our Boston chapters, has been part of CCL for 3 years. Last week, she published her 400th letter to the editor. 400th letter to the editor. And if you read Judy's letters, none of them are ever just kind of phoned in. They're all interesting. A lot of them are funny. So that is really, really remarkable. And congratulations, Judy. This really isn't anything that we would take credit for, but I do want to mention that tomorrow in Boston, Bob Inglis is receiving the Profile in Courage Award from the Kennedy Center. And for such a courageous American to be recognized that way, I think it's something that we are all really, really happy about. So just so you know, Bob Inglis is receiving the Profile in Courage Award, and I think all of us couldn't be prouder of a really courageous American. All right, then the last thing on this is that I just want to mention that I appreciate all the people who have been promoting the Earth 2 campaign. You know, Cheryl McNamara in Toronto has really tried to find a creative and fun way to do outreach and to help build the organization. So to kind of do it with a little bit of humor, a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, has just been lovely, and thank you if you signed up for it, but more importantly, if you sent that to other people and had them sign up as a way of helping to build our movement. Okay, I also want to ask Lene Pentengill to come on just a moment, our development director who's developing a new program of planned giving. So are you there, Lene?
I am. Hi, Mark.
Morning.
So today we're announcing the launch of our Planned Giving Society, Citizens Climate Legacy Club. And this is a way for our members to support our work to address global warming for generations to come. So you can participate by naming Citizens Climate Lobby or Citizens Climate Education as a beneficiary in your will, retirement plans, or insurance policy. And the benefits to joining include a very nice looking certificate, an invitation to our planned giving and major donor luncheon that's a part of our conference in DC each year. But most importantly, it's the knowledge that your dedication to a stable climate goes on for generations to come. So if you're interested in joining or have any questions, please contact me at lynae@citizensclimate.org. So that's lynae@citizensclimate.org. And you can also find me on the website staff listing. So thanks so much.
Great. Thank you. We're excited about that. And thank you, Judy and Davia, for helping to launch that also. Okay, I want to go over what we're doing in Canada and the U.S. So in Canada, we're going to be using this month's Laser Talk to prepare talks for the town hall meetings and letters to the editor. We have a crowdfunding campaign happening, and we have a big lobby day in the first week of June in Ottawa. So please start making requests for your meetings with your MPs. Obviously, between that, the lobby day in Ottawa, and the conference in D.C., June is going to be a really big month for all of us. Okay, so then in the U.S., we're going to ask you to begin to develop the plan for your meetings with your member of Congress that will happen during our lobby day in D.C. So we'd like you to look and see all the work you've done with your member, and then what would be the right things for us to discuss. So, you know whether we've talked about them with Remy or not. You know whether we've talked about the basics of fee and dividend. So what exactly should we be accomplishing there in June? Just so you know, some of the things that we'll be pushing out to you with your schedule this year is, in addition to Tony's information that I mentioned, people have been updating the bios, so you'll get a bio for the people that you're meeting with. Over 200 of them have been updated. If you're one of the people updating the bios, if you could please complete that. The format this year is fantastic, and it's giving people great additional information. Then the person who's the meeting lead and the liaison will also get the meeting notes from all the previous meetings. So you'll have that information, and you're not going to have it today, but for your member of the House and Senate, you should have a good idea of the kinds of things that we should be working on to make sure that we maximize the opportunity. Whether we want everybody to have the experience of participating in the conference, you may be coming or not, but we want to make sure that your voice is heard in planning the meeting so that what you want to get done with your member of Congress is happening. That also leads to the second message, which is to make plans to enroll allies and volunteers to participate in our Congressional Message Day, June 22nd. So if you're not coming to the conference, We want you to call in and let your member of the House and Senate know that we want you to support carbon fee and dividend. When you talk to other groups, if they don't want to be that explicit, they could certainly say we want you to take action on global warming. So we want to include as many people as possible like we did last year. You know, one of the things that was really fun was we had a rock star send out a message to all his group telling them to call in last year. So that was really, really fun. And then we're asking, we have 10 laser talks plus one. We call that 10 plus one, not 11 for some reason, that we want you to prepare for this year's conference. And it's not, obviously, the conference as a deadline is a good reason for all of us to up our preparation. But these are ones that are essential for all of us. So whether you're coming to the conference or not, we have five this month that we'd like you to start practicing. And as part of that, we just put the one line of the gateway belief from Anthony's research that I think couldn't be stated more brilliantly. He stated 97% of climate scientists are convinced. That is such an important word. It's not believe, it's not think, it's not agree. 97% of climate scientists are convinced based upon the evidence. Again, a brilliant phrase. It's not based on some modeling, based on somebody they talk to, but based on the evidence that human-caused global warming is happening. We really want you to incorporate that into your letters to the editor, into your op-eds. I don't think it's helpful with people who deny climate change. That's just starting an argument. But again, the vast majority of the world are not people who deny what's happening. So what we want to do is make a very strong statement in all of our letters, our op-eds, when you make talks to the public. 97% of climate scientists are convinced, based upon the evidence, that human-caused global warming is happening. All right, everybody, I'm going to unmute all the lines. If you all want to shout out your own thank you to Tony Leiserwitz for being on the call and see if you could pronounce his name correctly, that would be awesome. Bear with me just 1 second to unmute the lines.
All guests have been unmuted. Thank you.
Thank you from Ground Zero.
Thank you. Is that you, Tony? I'm going to close the line now.
Okay.
Thanks so much. It was a wonderful call.